Welcome to Rodney Veal's Inspired By, a production of Public Media Connect, the regional partnership of CET in Cincinnati and Think TV in Dayton. Rodney Veal, our host for this podcast, is an independent choreographer, interdisciplinary artist, and all-around fan of all things arts and creativity. And he's excited to share another great conversation with you. Thank you for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to the Rodney Veal's Inspired podcast. And today I am having what is going to be a fun and fabulous conversation with the one and only Jen Perkins, who is an artist extraordinaire, collaborator, a recent transplant to our region, but nonetheless, who is making an impact on the art scene here and has a lot of thoughts and ideas and things to share. She is fabulous. I think that's the only word I can describe. We have so much fun. We had a conversation before and I loved it. I still think, all the good trouble that we can get into once this podcast is over. So without further ado, Jen Perkins. Welcome,
hey.
Jen. Now, that's an introduction.
spill the tea, Rodney.
We will tell, and that's what this conversation is about. If we must, we will go there. But Jen, I love the fact that someone recommended you for the podcast, and it was Curtis Bowman. We'll give a shout out to Curtis, who is fabulous force of nature in her own right. It says you got to have Jen on the podcast. And so I had a conversation with Jen that lasted 2.5 hours, and we just talked about everything under the sun, and she's that fantastic and that fabulous. But what I loved is I want people to understand and know that your story and your journey, because you're not a native Daytonian. You're not a native Ohioan.
Yes, I am.
You are?
I was born here. I was born at Good Sam.
Oh, that's right. You were born in Good Sam.
Yeah.
But you left.
Yeah.
But you
I left. Did. I left. I left when I was like 3.5 because my father had finished up at the theological seminary. He got his master's in divinity and he was a minister. So I'm a preacher's daughter. Go figure, right? Super typical, stereotypical. But he entered into the military after a number of years of working for the church. It wasn't challenging enough for him. And it didn't pay enough either. So he ended up going into officers training school. And, you know, I'm a military brat as well. So I'm a gypsy. I've moved around a lot. Like a lot my whole life. Some by you know, circumstance with parents, but mostly a lot by choice. And so you saying that I'm recent here, not too recent. I've been here 10 years. So, which is really weird because it's gone by so fast, so fast.
Well, 10 years. Yeah. I mean, but that's
a blink of an eye.
It is a blink of an eye. And that's, so that traveling, I mean, that's a whole thing that I'm always in, because I think we had our conversation. I'm a native Daytonian. I left to go to college and I came back. And so the opportunities were here. So what drew you, like, where were you in the world at the moment when the decision was to come back to Dayton? What was the draw?
So I am a cartophile. I really love maps. Like, I can just look at atlases for fun. I love geography. And I was looking at like Facebook, and my cousin was talking about where he worked in Columbus. And so then I zoomed in on Columbus and I was looking around, and then I thought, oh, I wonder if I can see my old house where I used to live in Columbus. And so then I went and did the street view of that. Like I went to CCAD. So I was downtown in Columbus. So I'm like looking around and, oh yeah, there's the old house, looking at the old neighborhoods. And then I zoom back out, you know, because I'm like on Google Earth or, you know, Google Street Maps and all that. And then I looked over at Dayton, and then I looked at Dayton and I'm like, oh, I wonder if I can find where I grew up as a little girl. And then I went to, because I lived in the Dayton View Triangle right by the seminary, and I lived on near Malvern. And what was it called? Something Nita or Alameda. I lived on Alameda. And anyways, I got on the street view and I looked at the street of where I lived as a child. And it was like this bomb blew up in my chest. Like it was just like this, this thing, it hit me. And because the street looked exactly the same as when I was a little girl. And all of a sudden, there was a voice in my head that was like a PBS announcer voice, kind of like a Morgan Freeman type voice. And the voice said, "The salmon swim thousands of miles to return to their place of their birth to spawn."
That's the phrase. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I heard. I and I said, "Who's that? Who's?" I mean, it, you know, it was my overmind or it was whatever it was, but I heard it and I'm like, okay. And then I started looking at real estate because basically we had been in contract to buy a house in Portland and things fell through with my husband's job and everything. And we were literally like at the appraisal, like we were right at the end and then just everything fell apart. So I was pretty bummed. But then I just had that message and I'm like, what is that? Like what? Moving back to Ohio, like what? I started looking at Trulia and like real estate sites. And I started looking at the houses and the prices at that time. And I was gagging. Like, I was just like, are you kidding? Like, these are beautiful houses for like $30,000, $40,000. I couldn't even wrap my mind around it. So I stalked the market for 2 years out from Portland, Oregon. And then my husband always was saying, when we buy a house, we're going to buy it for cash and we're not going to have any house payments. And I'm like, oh, stop. Like, you're going to pull 200 grand out of your butt. Like, get, stop. And that was real. Like,
get real. I mean, stop. Let's be honest.
Like, just, but anyways, I would listen to him and he would say this. And that was like his little mantra. We're going to buy a house for cash. And I was just like, okay. But I, you know, thinking Portland. No, it wasn't Portland. So we bought our house in Five Oaks, sight unseen. I had people come here and scout it out for me. And I literally went to the real estate place when I flew back, had a one-way ticket with both kids. My husband was still in Portland and wrote a check. And the people at the real estate office, they were like, oh my God, this is like the easiest real estate transaction we've ever done. And got the keys. Here we are.
That's a kind of the word I want to use for it is like, it's not just guts, not gutsy. It's bold. That's bold. Like there, I'm sure people listening to this going, I would never, I need to research and oh no. I mean, you really went all in. What was your husband think of that?
He was along for the ride because he knew that I was tired of moving and we were basically getting evicted not by any bad means, but like our landlord in Portland, they were going to raise the rent. Oh, but we want our kids to live here and their friends, they want to all live here, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And so I was just, all I could think about was like, oh my God, we're going to have to move somewhere. And then when we buy a house, we're going to have to move again. And I was just kind of tired and I had two small children, like literally like a newborn ish and a 4-year-old. Yeah. So I was like, no, I'm not playing this anymore. And I don't know what I stalked the market for 2 years. So I was doing my research. I was doing my research.
You were doing your research. So this wasn't just a flippant sort of like, and next day
No.
But it's still a bold move.
But yeah, I found, you know, I got a real estate person because we were, we were working with USAA because my husband was in the military and, you know, I found an agent here and, you know, she hooked me up with the paperwork. I made a bid on this house. It was a HUD repo. And I bid what they were asking because I was like, it was already so low that I was like, oh, yeah, I'm not going to try to underbid that. So, yeah. And then I won the bid and here we are.
And here we are 10 years later.
Yeah.
I love the fact, I love origin stories because I feel like I think we talked about that because I live in Wright Dunbar. Mm-hmm. And the house was a dollar. And so, yeah. You know, 26 years ago, 27 years ago, best decision ever made. And
this was
the best decision. This is,
yeah, this was the best decision that my husband and my husband is also an artist, that we could possibly make for ourselves as working artists and as parents. I wanted my kids to have the security and to grow up in a house, like one house. I have no concept of what that is like at all. Not one. I think the longest I ever lived in a house growing up was like 3 years. So I don't know what it's like to just live in a house in the same house until you graduate and go to college, and then your parents still live in the house. I have no concept of what that's like. So
you're like one of the, I have a really good friend who actually lives in Olympia, Washington. Mm-hmm. And it's a very similar thing, because her husband was in the military and they traveled and they moved. They finally found their forever home. That moment of like, I need permanence. We're done.
Yeah.
You've retired from the military.
Yeah.
This is it. Yeah. I need down the roots.
I was 40. I was 40 years old and I'm like, I am buying a house. Boom. That's it. End of story. Like, I'm done.
I love it. I love it. Which is giving hope and encouragement to other people. Make that decision and stick to it. Which I think I'm not going to be an armchair psychologist or therapist, but I just feel like that's your MO. It's like, okay, I got this idea. I'm running with it. And so, I mean, just that alone, it's just like, that's why I'm like, I fell in love with Jen because I love it. And we're going to get in good trouble in the community. So I have a question about, because this shows up, this podcast is about creativity. How did you get into this art realm? Because I think that's a very interesting, what started this idea of creativity and art making? Because to be honest, I mean, you didn't set up roots. You were moving and traveling. Was the art the constant?
Always. I started drawing like as soon as I could start holding a pencil or a crayon. I have memories of being like, before I was even in kindergarten, I was drawing on my wall in my bedroom, and I was drawing behind the drapes in the living room. And I would draw cephalopods, which is what little kids draw. They draw a head with like the arms and the legs sticking out of the head. That's like a stage of development. And they all had top hats. And sometimes they would have fangs because I was really intrigued by vampires, but they were little cephalopods. And that's what I remember drawing. And I love top hats. Probably because, you know, I watched Sesame Street and, you know, The Electric Company and stuff like that. But I started drawing at a very, very young age and painting. And I was always, you know, encouraged, you know, I was always bought, you know, supplies. And, you know, I did like Saturday morning enrichment classes. And even in elementary school, I was kind of taken aside with my art teacher, who actually, Doug Feely, I don't know how you pronounce his last name, I never know, but he was really good friends with my elementary art teacher. They were kind of in some of the same circles up in Toledo and Bowling Green and things like that, because I lived with my grandparents for 3 years. And he saw what I was doing, and he knew it was like different from what other kids were doing. And so he kind of took me under his wing. And when I was in second grade, when other kids had to do silent reading, I was allowed to go down to the art room and work on whatever I wanted to, which is what I always chose ceramics, because that was one of the things that they usually didn't have little kids do, was work in clay, because it's so, you know, messy and whatever. But I would make masks and pizzas and Easter baskets with eggs, and, you know, I would make everything, and then they would fire them for me, and I would glaze them, and I would go down and work by myself. Kind of special privilege. And maybe it's because they saw I was a very depressed kid for many years after my parents' divorce. I think now hindsight, you know, I can look back and see that I was different. You know, I wasn't like the I wasn't like the other little kids. And so I think they just kind of said, hey, let's do something a little special for her because, you know, it might help her at that time. So, but yeah, I started doing ceramics, and then, you know, I continued on with the ceramics and Saturday morning enrichment classes at the University of Findlay, and, you know, all through middle school, high school, you know, just, it's always been art. And then I applied my senior year, got a really nice scholarship to CCAD, and went to Columbus College of Art and Design, where I got my bachelor's. I think there were a few years when I was working professionally in the arts field. I was working when I was in Portland, I was working in a porcelain company, and I was also working for a mural company, and we would travel a lot to California, and we did a lot of huge commercial, you know, really lots of commercial work, lots of restaurants and hotels and private residencies of, you know, very wealthy people who had their second homes in like La Quinta and Palm Springs and Palm Desert and all that. So this was back during Clinton. Okay. So
this is pretty good. Back in the 90s. Okay. I love the fact that we're having 90s references.
Look, we're talking right at the Y2K, you know, and the economy, like people still had disposable income. I mean, it was just a different situation back then. But when I was actively working in these, you know, artistic fields, I actually wasn't doing my own art at that time, because I was doing art for a living all day long for other people. But that's when I started getting into music, and I started playing the drums at like 20, I don't know, 26, 25 years old. I got a drum kit. I was in multiple bands. It was something that I had wanted to do from the time I was a little girl, play the drums. But nobody ever facilitated that with me. And then I used to hear from my mom, like, well, girls don't play drums, or can't you just play the piano, or can't you play the clarinet? I'm like, no, you know.
You would have banged, like, drum, rhythmic percussion is something.
Yeah, yeah, that's my thing.
That. Yeah, that's your jam. Okay, yeah. Okay.
But so I did that for many years, and I wasn't, and so I was more active in the music scene than I was the art scene. In Portland, which was a great place to be in the music scene. I mean, like, not gonna lie. It was my very first performance. I was on stage at the Satyricon, which is where Nirvana played for the very first time in Portland. And that was my first show. And I was up on the drummer stage. So it's like the stage and then the drummer stage. And I was like, woo, I wasn't prepared for that.
That's a unique position. I don't think people understand, like, when the drummer's stage is elevated above.
It was amazing. It was amazing. I got off stage, actually, at the beginning of my very first show, like, my ride cymbal, part of my hardware, fell off during when I was playing. And I was like, oh my God, is my cymbal going to fall off when I'm playing? But it managed to stay on. And before the show, I had like had a couple cups of coffee, thinking I would need the extra energy. And yeah, I did not need that. So I get off the stage, I take my drum kit apart, have half a beer, took a half a draw off of a cigarette, and then ran to the bathroom and puked my brains out right after. It was like it was really hardcore, you know, and it was so punk rock.
It's so fun, Greg. And I love that, because, well, you know what it is that it's not just adrenaline. It's adrenaline, and it's another thing. Ooh. I know what that is. And a lot of performers have that situation. Because I, you know, I used to dance, and it was like,
you don't know you're going to get it. You don't know. I wasn't prepared.
No,
I was not prepared.
The first time I ever choreographed a ballet, I was in rehearsal, the first rehearsal. I'm doing it. I was all nervous. He did all the preparation. And as soon as they all left, I went into the bathroom and just projectile vomited into the toilet. I was like,
yep.
Yep. I was like, yeah, because you're like, oh, I'm like, what is this, right?
Yeah.
Like, should you do this if you're this stressed by it? And you realize it wasn't stress.
No.
Said, no, it's not stress. It is, your adrenaline was in overdrive because you found your thing.
Yes. Yes. But that was that was a surprise.
That high is a real high.
It never happened again. Luckily, I never repeated that again. But that was, you know, my very first time on the stage, on a stage, and mic to the hilt. Okay. Because it was like new band night, you know, new band night at Satyricon, you know, and that Satyricon is long gone, that club.
Is it long gone? Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, did you ever think like, oh, you know, if I do the art, you know, you're doing the porcelain company and the mural company. Did you ever think, you know what, let's stick with this band. Let's stay behind the drums. Let's really keep going. I mean, did you ever think that that was the pathway versus?
I actually talked to Carrie Brownstein, and she was asking me about like, oh, would you be able to tour? I've got this band, they need a drummer. Like offered to, you know, and because I ran into, because Carrie Brownstein, I was at the time I was working after the jobs, the art jobs dried out. It was after 9/11. That's when the art jobs died off. It was done. And so I had to get a job, and I worked at Banana Republic for like a couple years actually. And Carrie Brownstein would come into the shop, and I ended up giving her one of like the demos from the band I was in.
Carrie Brownstein.
Yeah.
And for people who don't know, that is one of the originators of Portlandia.
Sleater-Kinney.
Sleater-Kinney, but didn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. I was like, a Sleater-Kinney. Yeah. Which is another, well, Daytonians is like, that was about the same time as like the Breeders. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like, you know, these girl bands. I was like, you know, I hate that phrase girl.
Riot like, girls.
Yeah, like, oh, Riot girls and all. Yeah. But
La Negra, you know?
Yeah. They were doing cool shit.
So this is pre Portlandia. Okay. She was just doing band stuff then, but yeah. And then she kind of offered like, oh, I have a friend. Da, da, da. And at the time I was in school, I was working, and I did not take that leap of, no, that was not my, I didn't do it.
It just wasn't on the bingo card of life. I mean,
no, it terrified me, because I'm a person who needs some kind of stability, like with money or my school. I was in school, and I was like, I can't just take off, you know?
Wow.
But it was offered to me. So that was like, oh, wow. I mean, like, that was one of those, like, you know, sliding door choices. If I would have made that choice, woo.
I don't know.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. And you don't do, as artists, we don't do the what ifs that often. Mm-mm. I think once we go through the door, we go through, we just keep going because we look for the next door, next set of doors, you know, which
that
is
was
really...
the only, that was one of the only moments in the last, and it's so weird to say 23 years that, you know, that I've had that was so like, wow, you could have chosen this other path, but I didn't. And I'm happy that I didn't. I'm okay. You know, I mean, I still have drums in the basement. I don't play very much anymore. I love it, but I think kids having children and just doing that thing, I don't want to be out past 10. I'll just be honest. Like, I don't.
Who does at this age? I mean, let's be very clear. I find fascinating is that people have, that we've talked to on the podcast and just in life, they always had other things, other interests. And it was like, okay. I'm like, and I always go, well, why did you choose this versus that? And they said, it just didn't feel right. It wasn't what I really wanted to say or do, or that it didn't present itself at the right time, because you knew you were in school, you had kids,
Well, that I did not have kids at that time. I wasn't even with my partner at that time, but it just, the timing, you know, wasn't right for me. And it was just, but it was tantalizing. I tell you.
It is tantalizing. It's, the temptation is real in that regard. And I mean, I just think about that, because it's like every person we've talked to has said there was this other thing. And I'm like always surprised by. And music seems to be the it's either music or movement. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They were like, they were movers. Like they were like, I danced. I'm like, wait, what? You did modern dance? I mean, there's a playwright who was dancing and Geraldine Blunden at DCDC loved him. And he's a playwright. I was like, you could have been a, he says, yeah, but I went this other way. And I'm like, okay. It is always music, movement, or visual art. Mm-hmm, and so I think that's why we got along really well. Other than we share some things about astrology that I was like, yes, I thought that was pretty cool, which I thought was really cool. By the way, let's take a moment and then we'll come back and then we'll kind of just talk about the art making process.
Hi, I'm Mike Shea, communications specialist for Think TV and the producer of this podcast. Thank you for listening to Rodney Veal's Inspired By. This podcast is a production of CET and Think TV, two local PBS stations. As PBS stations, the work we do online, on air, and in the community is supported by listeners like you. If you're enjoying the show and would like to support our work, please consider becoming a member at cetconnect.org or thinktv.org. Plus, when you sign up to donate at least $5 a month, you'll get access to special members-only streaming videos on the PBS app through Passport. Learn more at cetconnect.org or thinktv.org. Thanks for listening, and back to the show.
All right, so we're back with Jen Perkins. And Jen, I mean, just the stories about music, I mean, just that journey. But I kind of want to focus in on... Uh-huh. on this visual art journey. Your relationship and this collaboration with the mm-hmm. other artists came from the music.
So the third band that I had been in Portland, we were called Vela Wave, and the first woman that was like the main like songwriter, singer, she and her partner, they got pregnant, and that pretty much was like, okay, I guess we're done now because, you know, we're going to have a baby and they're going to start a new path on life. And Maggie and I, unbeknownst to both of us, we both went to the audition, and she's a bassist, and she had been in a few bands in Austin, Texas, because she had moved to Portland from Austin, and we met at an audition, and then the woman that was wanting to do the band, she was very passionate, but she was really passionate about U2. I'm not a big fan. But she loved their music, and Maggie and I were not on that page at all, like whatsoever. So we were just kind of like, yeah, I don't think this is going to be a fit for us. And then I found out through spending time with her, you know, about her art and her sculpting and she was sculpting down, you know, limestone, Texas limestone, and she was carving and, you know. And at that point, I was looking for a studio because I knew I had a series that I wanted to make because I had gotten back into art at that point. After 2001, when my art job stopped, that's when I got back into painting again and creating because I wasn't doing it for a living anymore. But yeah, we ended up getting a studio together. And then she ended up like selling all this stuff. And she was talking about like, I want to go to Tino's and I want to learn from the masters. I want to learn marble carving. I want to go to Greece. That's where you got to go. And I'm like, go. I'm like, do it. Go and do it. Sell your stuff and go. And she did. That's history. Like that was the last. She hasn't been back to the States since 2009. She has been over there.
She's all in. This is her.
110%.
Like the thing.
Wow, that is her. I mean, like, talk about living the dream.
Both of you, you both stayed in touch. You guys you were friends for like, yeah, there was this kind of kismet sort of like, we're friends.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, there were a few years during babies, both of us babies, that we, you know, once in a while we would Skype or something.
Once you have that initial joining together of like kindred spirit mm-hmm. and friendship, it's not about like constantly being in a friend's face. It's just the fact mm-hmm. that you share a bond, and it's like the bonds never break. You picked it up after, you know, you're having kids, you're living, you're buying this cool house and you know, and Five Oaks. And then it's that reconnection. So about 7 years ago, you reconnected on this.
I want to say it was like at least seven. I, it could be a little bit longer.
I
don't really remember. It's been so long.
Because you're just friends. I mean, it's just a friend. So what drove the idea of collaborating and creating this exhibition that's up?
This was like way before, you know, we were even thinking about the, you know, the grant wasn't even in our mind or anything like that. But we were like, what can we do together? Like, we should do something together. And she was always saying stuff like that. And the only thing I'd ever collaborated on was obviously like murals, painting murals with my husband and doing like large commercial projects with him and on the computer and things like that. But this is a whole other ballgame because, you know, she does three-dimensional marble sculptures. I'm like, how are we supposed to blend this together? You know, but it wasn't until she met Lou, which is her neighbor in the village. And he's been there about 7 years. He's an older man, like a kind of retiree American expat. He's a sculptor. And she saw his, and then there's a term that's an Italian term, and I can't remember what it is, but it's when you do very forced perspective, very shallow reliefs that are not very tall, but they have so much depth. And he carves them out of clay and then casts them out of plaster, and they're just amazing. And then all of a sudden, like, she saw what he was doing, that he was painting them, and she was just like, oh my gosh. And both of us kind of had this aha moment, like, oh wow, like we could do that. Like, we could do that. How do we blend the two of them together? So that's what we did. But seeing his work, I think, was a huge catalyst to know that it is possible what we were kind of thinking in already, but just seeing it. I mean, it's done in a different way. Obviously, he doesn't carve marble. He carves into very soft clay. He makes everything with soft clay. But the concept of casting it and doing the silicone mold and doing the mother mold and making the cast out of plaster and then painting it, that was it.
Talk about how you stepping outside of this collaboration. That was your world and your practice. You're going from painting and murals and kind of in that sort of two-dimensional world. And now you're coming into this three-dimensional world. Was that did that feel like a natural progression?
Oh yeah. Well, it's like revisiting an old friend, honestly, because my senior thesis in college was ceramic sculpture, partly ceramic sculpture. It was ceramic sculpture and it was mixed media work. And so, of course, you know, working for that porcelain company, it was all two-part molds. We did porcelain flip casting. I had already started putting my feet back in before we even solidified what that project that we're doing is, and using wood and attaching wood to wood panels and really, you know, making art for, especially for like seeing impaired people to touch, like you could actually feel the painting, you know. And most people like don't touch the paintings, but I'm just like, hey, touch my painting, touch them. Yeah, they're meant to be touched.
I firmly believe in that. I feel like that there's that tactile experience.
Yeah.
There are other senses that can be engaged in the art making process, and we shouldn't be so precious about it.
I've worked with Molly Brockman and her vision for having a vision impaired, you know, art gallery. So I did a thing with them last year, I want to say, and I had a number of pieces there that I brought so people that were vision impaired could feel and touch and, you know, the whole thing. But they were, when they came and did a studio visit and I got to show Molly all of my pieces and she got to feel them all, like she was just blown away. She was so happy to be able to touch someone's art, you know? And I'm like, yeah, that's what I want people to do, is to touch it. And especially even with encaustic, you know, occasionally you have to polish it, you know, to kind of, you know, it is affected by humidity and things like that. So you really, you know, you want to give it a nice shine sometimes.
And I love that intentionality of like saying, you know, there's a segment of the population and that needs to be engaged into the art making and the creative realm. I love the fact that we can see each other as we're talking in the podcast. And it's like the body language is like, there's a total relaxed, chill vibe, like, folks, I make stuff that's three-dimensional. Touch it. It has shape and form. And have have at it, which is kind of cool. Do you still let people touch your art?
So when I have my thing at the library this Saturday, I am going to have things for people to touch. It's going to be marble. That. It's going to be all the marble pieces that you can hold and touch and feel the carving. And it's all the Naxian marble that I brought back, some of which I carved, some of which Maggie carved. The small pieces that she could mail to me. Now, the pieces that I made copies of, they're massive, okay?
They're massive, okay.
They're massive, and they would cost an arm and a leg to ship them here, which is why we did what we did. And I mean, it was still pricey to ship the molds. You know, it was not cheap.
It was not cheap. Wow. No. And so that's another thing about when you're working in these kind of, like, that kind of material that's heavy and large scale. The cost. I think people don't understand. You as artists have to figure all that in to show the work if you want to show it outside of your region.
That's why, you know, even if these pieces were cast in ceramic, they would be ungodly heavy. But plaster is so much lighter than clay. Mm-hmm. So that's what I love about being able to do that. And the fact that I can get the paint, the both types of paint that I use on these pieces, I can get them to look like fired ceramics.
Wow.
Without having to do any of that. It's like, it's very satisfying because I don't have a kiln. I don't really want a kiln. I mean, I love clay, don't get me wrong, but like the waiting, the firing, the shrinkage, is the glaze going to run? Is the glaze going to turn out? Do you have the glaze thick enough? There's no control for me. Yeah. I need more control. So what I'm doing is like, It's good.
I love it, and it is. It's fantastic stuff. What you're talking about, and I think that's a really important. I think people like with ceramics, because Bing Davis works in ceramics, and he's doing these massive cylinders. And I'm going, how do you know when it's done? How do you know? How do you? He goes, you trust. There's a trust factor. There's a faith factor. It is what it is. Once it's done, there's no going back. But but the way you work, does it allow for you to kind of go, I like it, but I could change it? I mean, do you do that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I can still, now, not with the form per se. The form, once it sets up and it's hard, it makes it a little hard to carve into. But with the painting, that's where I usually, like, I have to force myself to stop, or I have to be like, I think I'm done. I think this is it. You know, I think I've reached... It just, for me, it's like this, when it looks the way I want it to look, then I know what it looks like. And I'm like, okay, this is it. And I can stop. Like, and that's a good feeling. But a lot of my paintings, just my paintings in general, because I work in multiples and, you know, I'll have like, I probably have about 12 paintings just sitting around my studio in various states of, when are you ever going to come work on me again, Jen? Like, you have been neglecting us, because I will start things and I will get them like halfway. And then I don't know if it's because I have ADHD probably. And then I start on something new, and it's just like, the ideas are coming so fast that I just have to kind of do and do and do and do and do. And I get all of the pieces to some stage. And then eventually, and I do, and this is what Brian always makes fun of me for, because he totally, like, you never finish anything. And I'm like, I do finish something when I have a deadline. Yeah, I can do it. But, you know, they are all just there waiting for me to come give them love again. And, you know, now that I'm done with this big series, I can do that. Like, and I'm really excited to be able to go back and pick up where I left off with so many pieces. It's going to be refreshing to be able to like give them love again and then take what I know now from what I experienced this last year.
It not just allows you to do it, you see it from a different angle or different perspective.
Oh, it's completely. Like
your perspective has now been altered.
When I came back from learning the relief sculpture, I started carving into my pieces like it was marble.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, look at this. Look what I'm doing. And Brian's like, wow. Like, you know, I'm just showing him my stuff. He's like, wow, that's, I said, look at this mark making. I wouldn't have done this mark making before, but because of just like, you know, chip with the tools. And I don't know, it just kind of like turned on something in my brain, and it made it so, you know, I'm looking at everything differently. And even though marble is not my thing, and it won't really ever be my thing, it's just not. I love it. I appreciate it. But the whole process of creating the forms and being able to cast those forms and being able to add those forms back into my pieces, oh, I'm 100%. Like, I am on board. Like, I can't wait. I really can't wait to start, you know, making my pieces more three-dimensional with, you know, objects that I create out of clay and do the whole silicone mold making and the whole thing, because I will be using clay to do that for sure.
I love it because you talk about your process in such a playful terms, and I love that. Do you consider, I mean, do you think about it that way? I mean, do you, I play. When I'm making, I'm playing. I'm just like, kid in the candy store. I'm like, oh,
yeah,
what's this? What if I did this to paper? Because I work in paper, and I start touching paper all the time going, it's like I feel like that character from Coming to America. This is beautiful. What is it? Velvet? And I'm just always touching and kind of, what can this paper be manipulated into?
I have been teaching myself, or rather allowing myself, over the last number of years to play. To just play. Because I don't know if it was all the training at CCAD, and everyone was just like, it was just very like, they weren't big fans of playing. No, it was a very strict school, a very, very strict schooling when I was there. So I don't know if it's different now, but back in the 90s, it was analog, hands-on, Bauhaus. Just everything had to be just so. And I don't know, there wasn't room for playing. And you were constantly afraid of, if you were to go outside of the box too much, the critiques, what would be said. And I don't know.
The critiques are real.
It took me years to stop hearing the professor's voices in my head critiquing my stuff. Like, it took years. I don't remember when the voices stopped, but I got really serious for a number of years, especially getting back into the arts here in Dayton, and really like pushing myself to, you know, get my ideas out there. But I wasn't playing. I was not playing. I was very serious. And I just saw a lot of people around me playing, and it looked like they were playing. And I don't know. I wasn't there. I was maybe depression, stress. I don't know, but it's like an evolution. It's a conscious evolution for me. And I'm really happy that I came out on the other side, you know?
Like, right. Like, that phase is over.
Whew, yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can look, if you ever to see that work. I mean, it's very blatantly obvious. Like, I wasn't in the best of places. It's just, I don't know. Like, I look at it now, and I mean, I have it hanging in my house, and it's fine, and I like it, but I don't think I'll revisit it again.
And this playful phase that you're in is so exciting because it just kind of comes through and manifests in this conversation. And so that's why I'm like, that excites me. Like, that's why we had a 2.5 hour conversation, because I'm like, Jen's excited. I love it.
This is the first winter in most of the years that I've been here that I haven't been depressed. So it's a win. It is a total win. And it's been years. I mean, I've struggled with depression a lot. And I finally found a combination of supplements and things that really, really help. And it's just like a whole new, you know, it's a whole new world for me. And, you know, doing things, taking care of myself psychologically, mentally, you know, setting boundaries with certain people that are not good for you. It's been a learning process. And then the last, I mean, you know, it all started during COVID. 2020, right. Baby, 2020. That was the dark night of the soul.
And we still are dealing with the ramifications of that.
Yeah, and I think that's fine. I think that's fine.
But it's also, we have to kind of, when we acknowledge it, know that that can't totally define who and what we are, because it was such a dark, love that, that dark night of the soul, because it was a very, very dark, intense place. And I don't ever want us to go back there. I mean, let's be very clear.
No,
yeah, we're done. No. I was like, yeah, we're golden. And, but I do know that that also triggered in a lot of creative folks a wave of ideas and thoughts. I love where I'm at, where I can, I get to observe people,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better term, blossom and manifest thoughts and ideas that are like, I never saw that coming from you, and it's cool. I love, it's like, and I want to be the biggest cheerleader. It's like, keep going, go Jen, you know, like, because that's what the arts community needs.
I think you're, and
the fact that you acknowledge that depression, you're not shying away from that in a conversation. Look, there are millions of Americans who are affected by depression. I've dealt with it, and I still deal with it. And we all deal with it in a different way, but we're dealing with it. But I also think being honest about it, very, very honest, that I go, the reason why I'm procrastinating is because the thought exhausts me.
I find myself in the past, even last year, I found myself missing opportunities to submit my art to places because of the depression, because it was too much effort to sit in front of a computer and do all the work and put yourself out there. And, you know, of course, fear of rejection and da 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 da, you know, it's all of the crazy self-talk, whatever. But it's amazing, like, when you can look back on that and say, okay, oh, I see what was going on. I understand what was going on. There are tells that we have to look for to prevent these episodes from happening. Or, you know, swimming for me, getting back into swimming was like an absolute 110 turnaround. You know, I fell off the wagon during COVID. All the gyms were closed and our pool was closed. And that is my grounding. Like, that's my jam, like swimming. That's my favorite form of physical exercise.
If you could make art in a pool, you would do it.
Well, I mean, or if I could like breathe underwater and have a tail and like live amongst the sea creatures, I would.
I love it. It needed to be a different sort of release, and that physicality of swimming and that meditative and calm. I walked. I mean, that's when the walking regimen started,
mm-hmm.
for me. I was like, oh, you're not the reason why you would have those moments,
mm-hmm.
is the fact that I didn't have a release.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
I was teaching, I was choreographing, mm-hmm. but it's not the same.
No, 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 no.
I needed something else, and that physical release. And it was, for me, it was walking.
Mm-hmm.
I just changed everything. So
yeah.
I think it's for our listeners, is like, that's the kind of, if that's a takeaway, that's a takeaway. Like, find something that will help release. It is a synergy of the body and mind. You would never think a dancer would say that, but I needed something beyond dance.
I mean, we were at the studio all those years. I mean, we were, during 2020 is when we moved upstairs in our building to the big, big studio.
I thought that was so cool that you moved into this larger space and you're in the Dayton Printmaking Co-op building,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
Okay. So people who are a local who listen to podcasts, which it is the space that you got, you just went, you went from a certain size space to.
Yeah. We were bursting at the seams. We had that little corner rotunda space, you know, and we were. Just there was no room to move anymore. I mean, my husband was painting 4-foot by 5-foot canvases and I was doing giant multiples. And I'm like, you know, we were asking the landlord, like, hey, do you have any other spaces? We can't sustain this anymore. And then anyways, like, and then Patrick Malk decided he was moving out. It was time to go home and be with we call it the critical parenting years. So yep. He was joining the critical parenting years because we've been there. It, you know, for us, it was 8 full years of critical parenting years where we made very little art. We were keeping our children alive. It wasn't about us. It was, you know, it was our children, and 110% about our kids. So, you know, there's a lot of missing years in there, but I don't miss them. I mean, you know, I don't miss it like for my, no, I have, my kids got 100% of my attention.
And that's kind of, that's really important for artists, because I think a lot of people don't realize the creativity is not going to leave you. You're not like a shark where you have to keep swimming or you stop breathing. You know, like you, the creativity will happen. It'll manifest itself when it needs to manifest itself, because critical parenting years, same thing about critical professional development. It was like, you know, like this other thing was taking over my life. And so I knew I started off as a visual artist. And so I went back to it because of COVID. I went back to my roots, and it was like, oh, I kept me in a studio with dancers and bodies and moving through space. Well, let's go back to that other form of creativity. It never left. It was there. It's still there.
It's like riding a bike. Mm-hmm. Once you know how to do it, you can put it away, that you can pick it up and you can get right back on. You might be a little wobbly at first. I was doing little bits here and there while my children were small, just very small pieces. And, you know, at like in our breakfast nook at the table, and I would set up my little encaustic station. And I mean, I was making things, very little things, because I had to. Linda Robertson was my teacher out in Portland, and I did like a full day workshop with her, and that was it. Like, and then that started me on my path. And because it was just one of the mediums that I did not learn in college. I learned egg tempera in college. I learned oil painting and everything else under the sun.
That's a thing that artists do. I mean, I think about Amy Diehl. Amy Diehl went from a certain type of influence of graphic design to three-dimensional structural pieces. I mean, I'm like Amy, where she just says, I'm just going for it. I'm like, things that I didn't learn to do, or things I never thought I could do, you just kind of go for it. And I think, is that something you think that people don't understand about artists and art making? Like, we just go, I want to try this thing. And we go out and try to figure out how to do this thing.
I'm not a one-trick pony. I am like completely not a one-trick pony. Even in college, I was not a strict painting major. I wasn't a strict ceramic major. I was everything. Like, I had to do it all. I mean, in those two venues, like mixed media, painting, drawing, collage. I have a lot of collage that I used to do. And then the ceramic sculpture. But like, I don't like being limited at all with what I want to experience or touch or feel or make. It just seems very one-faceted to me, and that's just not how I am. And some people, that's their thing, and if it works for them, great. But I think there are a lot of artists out there that need to explore, because it is part of our nature of being like inquisitive, you know.
Being curious.
Yeah, being curious. Yeah.
I've always felt that way, and I felt really strong about it. And I didn't know that was what I was missing until I got to grad school. For dance. When they told me, like, why is your work not representative of your interest in other things? And I looked at them, I'm like, I just never really considered it, which is why I'm coming to grad school. I want to explore all of these things. And so I think that's just really important. And I think it's important for the audiences as well. Don't just be like, I only love painting, or I only love dance. I just tell people, love it all. Go explore and see and experience it all, because it will inform you. I just feel like it's like to your point about the one trick pony. It's like, why are you not going to go see other artists? Why are you not going to go see other art forms? That confuses me. I will never understand that in a million years. So you have to be true to your nature as to what your creative process is. And I think I've yet to, and this may sound shady, I've yet to meet any artists doing this podcast or doing the show that did not have that sort of, I'm not a one-trick pony. Let me try all of these things. Let me go and explore. It's about the evolution. It's about evolution within the creativity. So that means you don't know. Like, oh, I got to, and the excitement and enthusiasm that they have manifests itself in the conversation, which is far more interesting to me than somebody that says, I only paint. And oils. I'm like, Okay. I don't know what to do with that, but right. Sure. Great. Okay. Good for you.
There are artists out there that are kind of, they do, I don't know. I mean, you go to the museums, right? You go to the museums and you see all the famous artists and they did the one thing, you know, and they did it really well. And it's great. But I guess that's why I really love looking at like the Dadaist and like the earliest, the people who were really, really branching out and doing all kinds of other things along with their painting.
Yeah, that's those are the artists. I feel like even though, you know, in our PC days, yeah, Picasso was problematic, but he also worked, he touched every, it was like the dude just did everything. And I just feel like, okay, you know, that's the same thing with the Dadaist and the Surrealist. Artists who work multidisciplinary, which is what you do, you're mm-hmm. working multidisciplinary. That's where the special sauce is, even for audiences. I mean, I really do think that that's what, we don't talk about it enough. Like, why do you think the audiences are drawn to certain artists? Because they're like, because they know that this is not definitively who they are. This is just a part of them. And it's the joy of discovering the multi facets and parts of them. We always do this as we come to the close of the podcast. If you had to give one word of advice to someone who is considering going on this kind of multifaceted journey of creativity and art making, what would be your advice to them?
Be true to yourself and what you love, and don't think about what other people are going to think about your work. Just do it.
Mic drop.
That's about all I can say about that, you know?
Yeah, but that's so true. And you are the living embodiment of that, and it's just so cool to have a conversation with you about it, which we'll have conversations off the outside of the podcast, by the way. You know that's
coming. Oh yeah.
Oh, you know these conversations are coming. As we sip our tea. It's gonna be
Let's have our tea.
So Jim, this has been fantastic. Thank you for being on the podcast and being so awesome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
Rodney Veal's Inspired By is a production of Public Media Connect, the regional partnership of CET in Cincinnati and Think TV in Dayton. There's a lot of great art happening around Southwest Ohio, and we're excited to be part of it. If you liked this episode, please subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can learn more and find the show notes at thinktv.org/inspiredby or cetconnect.org/inspiredby. Thank you.